Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, it's that time of year again, ladies and gents. It's time to saddle up and have ourselves a roundup of the Supreme Court of these United States. This is the time of year when I ask my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law to pick one case that he or she finds particularly interesting and to share a little bit of analysis of that case with us, and also, and this is key, a prediction about what the court will do. And what's really fun is that we've done this in the past. And so with those professors who have been on the show in the past, we're going to begin each of their interviews seeing how those predictions turned out. So without further ado, this year's 2012 roundup of the United States Supreme Court. Let's start with my good friend Judy Barger and an analysis of Frankie the Drug Sniffing Dog.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that you have a really interesting case to tell us about.
I do. I have a couple of cases, actually, that I'm going to talk about involving Frankie the Drug Dog.
Frankie the Drug Dog. Now, is Frankie the Drug Dog a boy or girl?
It's a girl.
A girl, okay.
Female.
Female, okay.
And the issue, and both of these cases actually are out of Florida, the issue is, in the first case, whether the police can use Frankie or any other drug dog to search around the outside of an individual's house. And by search, I actually should say sniff, because the issue is whether that constitutes a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
Now, when you say outside a person's house, I mean on their property?
On their property. And in this case, it was actually at the front door.
Okay, so the question is, can the police bring Frankie up to your front door and simply have her sniff your front porch and drug area?
Exactly, or even around the curtilage of the house, the curtilage being the very outside area.
The very outer extent, okay.
Generally, there's not a prohibition against the police just walking onto your property. Anyone can walk up to your front door and knock on the door.
Oh, okay.
The issue is whether they can bring the drug dog with them to sniff around to, and the real issue, the heart of the issue, is they're using the drug dog to determine what is inside the house. Something that they wouldn't be able to do without actually entering the
house.
Okay,
that's the difference. So normally speaking, the cops can walk up to my front door just like anybody else.
Exactly.
And if I recall correctly from my criminal procedure course 30 years ago, my goodness, that's it's a long time ago. You know, if they see something in plain sight, then they can, you know, act on that.
Only if it's outside the house.
Only if it's outside the house. Okay, so that's
they can't enter the house.
Can't enter the house.
Generally without a warrant. There are a couple of exceptions to that. If they gain the person's consent, they can enter the house. If there is an exigent circumstance, they can enter the house. But generally, and the Supreme Court's been pretty firm about that rule, police cannot enter the house without having a warrant for the most part.
Okay. I understand. So, but generally speaking, police are like any other member of the public. They can walk onto your property, but can they bring Frankie with them?
Exactly.
Knowing that she's sniffing you. Okay, what case is that called?
Exactly.
What's the name of it?
Jardines.
The Jardines case, okay.
Out of Florida.
Uh-huh.
And so it's actually a more fundamental issue in Jardine, and it is whether the dog sniff itself constitutes a search. And the reason why that's important is because if it's not a search, then the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to it. So it's a fundamental Fourth Amendment question. There are a couple of cases that the Supreme Court has dealt with previously regarding this issue, the issue of dog sniffs. And those cases occurred, one of them was in an airport where the dog was sniffing luggage in the airport, and the Supreme Court in that case held that it was not a search because it wasn't a significant enough interference with the individual's expectation of privacy.
So if I take my carry-on bag into an airport and it smells like something, I got to fully expect people might be able to smell it. You know, if they're sitting next to me or standing next to me in line, I've got a bologna sandwich in there that's a little bit too old, they can smell it, right? Or if I got a bag of marijuana, it's the same sort of idea. Am I stating that correctly?
It is. And also, what the Supreme Court was relying on with the dog sniffs in terms of holding that they weren't that it wasn't a search in that case and in another case involving a traffic stop where the police bring the drug dog to sniff around the car, which is a fairly common occurrence in most jurisdictions. The other thing that the Supreme Court relied on there in both of those cases was that the dog was only revealing illegal activity. He wasn't the dog. A positive alert only revealed illegal activity, and the court looked at it as much less intrusive than, for example, a physical search of the luggage or a physical search of the car. Hmm. Because if you have a physical search of the luggage, then the police officer can see everything that's in your
bag. They're pulling out your undies.
Exactly.
Okay, right.
Exactly. And if it's just a sniff, that's the outer part of it. They're not actually physically opening it. They can't see anything else in it. So that was another part of the Supreme Court's rulings in those cases. However, as the Florida Supreme Court noted, the U.S. Supreme Court was very careful to limit the holdings in those cases to those specific facts. And talking about the lesser expectation of privacy in your automobile out in the public when you're driving.
Right.
And, you know, in the airport. In that case, it ended up being, they ended up holding the luggage for too long. That was a separate issue. But the issue regarding the dog sniff, the court just didn't look at it as a significant infringement on the individual's privacy. So mm-hmm. that, in addition to the fact that the dog was only revealing what was would be illegal activity, led the court to say it wasn't a search.
Okay, but the home is the castle.
But the home is the castle.
Right, okay.
And the court has been very reluctant to allow the police entry into the home without having a warrant. In a more recent opinion in Kelo, the Supreme Court, per Justice Scalia, held that the police could not use a thermal imaging unit. And in that case, they were sitting across the street from the house. They weren't mm-hmm. even within the house, the curtilage of the home, when they aimed the thermal imager at the house. And they were actually investigating the same type of activity that the court was investigating in Jardine, which was marijuana growing.
Hmm. So
that was the target.
Well, thermal imaging is kind of scary because that technology gets better and better. I mean, they're looking at an image of you just walking around or
exactly.
doing things. Maybe you don't want to do a lot of things in your house. You really don't want to share with everyone. And just here's a disclaimer. If ever I am in an airport, police, you really don't want to be pulling my underwear out. You really don't want to be doing that. But that's a side issue. What's your thought here? What do you think the court's going to do on this drug sniffing in the home in the Jardine case?
Well, personally, I think that they're going to draw the line. Now, there are several ways that they could do that. And I think that the Florida Supreme Court did a good job of distinguishing the other cases, the case with the luggage at the airport and the case with the car during the traffic stop. I think that given the court's more recent jurisprudence in Kelo, that they are going to draw that line. Now, there are some other, they could do that in a couple of ways. They could say a dog sniff is a search when it's done around the curtilage of the home. They could also limit it to the facts of this case, because the other part of this case that the Florida court seemed to rely on was that it was a big show when the police came to do this. It wasn't just one officer with a dog walking up to the house. It was several officers. It was several cars that were sitting around
surveillance. Oh, right, the big truck with canine unit.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, right.
I mean, it was a big, and it took several hours, apparently, once the dog alerted. Then they got a search warrant. They used the dog alert as probable cause to get a search warrant for the house, and then the search warrant. Of course, executing the search warrant took a significant amount of time, too. But this Florida court seemed to look at that as a huge invasion of privacy. Now, we're not talking about a car on the side of the road and one police officer and a drug dog, but we're talking about, you know, a whole menagerie of individuals and police cars and vans sitting outside the house for several hours that where the neighbors could see and anyone walking down the street could see that. So the Supreme Court could say it is a search in this case, but, you know, based on that, too.
And if it is a search, then typically you need a warrant
exactly.
before you engage in that kind of behavior. Okay.
Exactly.
So your prediction is that probably the cops are going to lose this one.
I'm going to predict that the police will protect the house. Or, I'm sorry, that the Supreme Court will
protect
the
house.
They will continue to protect the house.
Well, thanks very much to Judy Barger of the Appalachian School of Law, who told us all about the Fourth Amendment and Frankie the drug-sniffing dog. Now I'm going to speak to my colleague Pat Baker, who made some predictions last year about a very interesting case out of Montana about a river, and has picked another case this year out of Arkansas about another river.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Now, last year you told us about a case from Montana that involved a river. What happened? What was that case about and what happened?
Well, the case was PPL Montana versus Montana. And the state had brought an action against the power companies that had built hydroelectric dams on the river.
Oh, yeah. This was all about who owned the river.
Because if Montana owned the river, then the power companies had to pay them for leases. And if the federal government owned the river, at least at those places where the power plants were, then the power companies didn't owe Montana any money, right?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Now, and so it all boiled down to who owned the river, and then that went into a lot of history, didn't it?
It did. It all came back to the equal footing doctrine, and when Montana became a state, the parts of the river that were navigable, the state gained title to that property. And the parts of the river that were non-navigable, the federal government retained title. And over the years, the federal government had sold and leased that property, and it had gone through numerous real estate transactions. And at the end, PPL Montana, along with some other power companies, had built hydroelectric dams at these periods at these places on the river where there was a steep decline in rapids, so right. that you have a consistent water flow.
Sure, and this is the very place you could typically not navigate because you got a waterfall or you got a really steep rocky area. Okay, and if I recall, there were two different tests that were being urged upon the Supreme Court. The state of Montana wanted one test, and the power companies wanted another about navigability, right?
Right. So it came down to what is the test for navigability, and the state of Montana said that when you determine the navigability of a river for tidal purposes, you look at the river as a whole. And the Supreme Court found that the Missouri, the Madison, and Clark Fork rivers were navigable as a whole, and then therefore the state gained title to that property. The federal government, and the correct test is that, you look at it section by section, meaning that some parts of the river are navigable while other parts of the river are not navigable. But you don't look at the river as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so upon review, the Supreme Court said, reverse the Montana Supreme Court decision because they had applied the wrong test.
I see. So Montana loses, the power companies win. But if I understood you last year, that was pretty much how people had been doing it for 200 years or 100 years, whatever it was. So, okay, that was something I think you predicted, right?
It is. And the interesting tidbit there is the main part of the evidence that was introduced at the trial court level were Lewis and Clark's journals. And
that's so right. Yes, I remember that. That was fantastic.
That was the key piece of evidentiary evidence in the case were Lewis and Clark's journals. So they continue to be relevant, 200 years later.
History rules, once again, in the U.S. Supreme Court in 2011, 2012. Okay, so what do you have for us this year? You're batting 1,000 so far. What do you have for it this year?
This year, I've got another river case, Arkansas
That's
Game
right.
and
You're
Fish.
You're a hunting, fishing kind of guy, aren't you?
I do. I enjoy the outdoors. So this case caught my eye for, several different reasons. And one of the reasons is, like I said, I do enjoy the outdoors, but also, too, focusing on, natural resources. There's only a handful of cases every year that come before the court, and they don't get a lot of publicity. So it's interesting to examine them and talk about them and look at something else besides your traditional high-profile issues that wind up there.
Okay, cool. So what's this one about?
Well, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission has brought suit against the federal government for a taking.
Takings. So they're saying the federal government has taken some property that belongs to Arkansas. What property?
It is along the Black River. Mm-hmm. And in the 1950s, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built a dam, Clearwater Dam, in fact. And as part of their charge to do flood control, they have to release water at different periods during the year, depending on, how much rain is occurring and to reduce flooding and to create predictability as far as river levels and things like that for agriculture and commerce. Mm-hmm. And so from the periods of 1993 to 2000, the Army Corps deviated from their schedule and generated more water than what they had been doing.
Okay, let's define that now. You have a reservoir. If it's for flood control, it means that you've got to leave room in that reservoir in order to accept extra water during the flood season,
exactly.
during the rainy season. So in anticipation of a flood season, the Corps of Engineers draws down that water level by releasing the water
and
downstream. And you're saying they had a schedule?
Right. The Army Corps has to publish what's called a release schedule.
Okay.
And, they notify people, and you can go online and look at different TVA lakes, for instance.
Sure.
You can go on and look at what is the release schedule, how much water are they going to be releasing, what are the release periods. Like I said, to create predictability for things like navigation, recreation, agriculture.
Right.
And so the Army Corps, for an eight-year period, had deviated pretty heavily from that schedule.
So what was the problem?
Well, in the deviation, they had flooded large areas of timber over an 8-year period. And as a result of that flooding, the timber has become diseased and unharvestable.
That's right, because they're covering the roots.
Exactly.
And then the roots grow upward rather than downward.
Right, so versus the oak trees, the roots, you know, growing deep in the ground, when you have just consistent water over top of the trees, the roots then grow along the surface. And then when you hit periods like what we have in the last few years with drought, those trees become diseased and they also can't, you know, they fall over and break, and it, you know, creates a huge mess.
So by deviating from the schedule, at least according to Arkansas, the Corps of Engineers had destroyed timber that Arkansas, what, wanted to sell?
That's exactly right.
And how much damage was Arkansas claiming?
Well, the D.C. trial court found that a temporary deviation, if it occurs enough, constitutes a temporary flowage easement, and they awarded the state of Arkansas $5.7 million in damages, you know, for the lost timber. And so the D.C. Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and found that a temporary deviation from the discharge schedule is not enough to constitute a temporary flowage easement. And while the Arkansas may have damages in tort liability, they don't have a claim to a permanent, you know, deprivation of property under the Fifth Amendment.
I see, and that's what we call a taking of property. Okay, and obviously then that's the issue that has to be resolved by the court now.
That's exactly right.
Which of these two holdings is going to be the one? What do you predict?
I predict that the federal government will uphold the Court of Appeals and find that temporary deviations from the discharge schedule do not constitute a flowage easement.
Why is that? Why do you think that?
Well, I think that based on kind of a trend that we're seeing, if we look at the PPL Montana case and then we look at Arkansas, you know, Game and Fish, what we're seeing is states employ a lot of creative lawyering to compensate for reduced state funds.
Oh, these are all the state attorneys general are grasping for some pieces of Uncle Sam.
Exactly.
Because of their, yeah, okay, now I understand that. And then you think the Supreme Court is going to be skeptical of these state claims.
I really do.
They're getting creative, are they?
They're getting very creative. You know,
okay.
The interesting thing about this suit is it's brought under the Tucker Act, which was passed in 1887, which waived sovereign immunity for states to bring claims against the U.S. Army Corps.
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask you about it. Normally speaking, nobody can sue the government, federal government, or the state governments without the permission of those governments. And that's a strange concept we call sovereign immunity. But you're saying in this Tucker Act,
right,
the U.S. government waives sovereign immunity for these types of claims.
That's exactly right. And that act was passed in the late 1800s. We see the PPL Montana dispute originated under the Equal Footing Doctrine, which, you know, pertained to Montana becoming a state in the late 1800s. So we see this law that's 125, 130 years old. We see, you know, creative lawyering.
Pat, I know exactly what's happening. You're having all these state governors look at their AGs and say, find me some money. The AGs look at their junior lawyers and they say, hit the statute books, young man, young lady, and find me a law that tells me I can sue Uncle Sam and get me some money.
I think there's a trend, and I think we're going to, I mean, you don't hear a lot of scholars talking about that, but as I look at the cases and I look at some of the decisions being handed down by the court, I think this is a theme that we're going to see for some time.
Okay, well, it'll be very interesting. So your prediction is that the state's going to lose again?
That is my prediction.
We'll come back in a year and we'll see how you do.
All right, great.
Thanks, Pat.
Oh, thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with six, count them six, of my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law, who have each picked an interesting case from this year's United States Supreme Court docket. We've already heard from Judy Barger and from Pat Baker about two fascinating cases. After the break, we'll come back and we'll hear from Charlie Condon and from Kendall Isaac. Stick around. Rolling, rolling, rolling.
Streams are swollen, keep them doggies rolling, roar hard. Rain and wind and weather, hell bent for leather, wishing my gal was...
You're listening to your weekly constitutional and our annual roundup of what's happening in the Supreme Court. Next up, we have Charlie Condon from the Appalachian School of Law, who's going to tell us about a fascinating case.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be here. I did the GPS case, and the question was whether or not a warrant was required before the police could attach a GPS unit to someone's vehicle,
right,
and leave it there and track them all over the place.
But that is such a cool issue. In fact, I was watching the reruns of Breaking Bad recently, and that was the storyline for a couple of episodes, is that they wanted to attach that GPS unit that is so high-tech, James Bond. So what did the court say?
Exactly, and I think the court decided this one correctly, as I predicted.
Oh.
They suggested that, yes, indeed, the police do need a warrant before they can actually attach the GPS unit. So as a footnote to this, I'd read a story shortly after that where the FBI and other police agencies had to run around and grab all of these units that were already attached.
So a week later, a bunch of people clandestinely taking the units out off of their cars.
That's the story I read, yes.
All right. Well, what about this year? Oh, and by the way, congratulations. You're batting 1,000 so far. What about this year? What's the case you're looking at?
Well, I have an interesting case to talk about today. It's called the Already LLC, Doing Business as Yum versus Nike.
Yum.
Yes, and these folks are talking about shoes. And Nike, of course, is famous for their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And this case is a trademark dispute. Mm-hmm. Nike is very protective, as other creative companies are, about the product that they have essentially created and developed and marketed over the years. And their claim in this case is that this company, Yum, is infringing on the design of their shoe.
So it's not the Nike logo or something, it's the actual shoe itself. They say it looks too similar to their shoe?
Exactly. And the situation is that Nike has a shoe called the Air Force One, mm-hmm. a very famous shoe. It's been around for years. And they claim, and in fact they took Yum to court over two different shoes that Yum marketed. One is called Soulja Boy, and the other one is called Sugar. And so Nike says these two shoes are infringing on the Air Force One trademark.
Mm-hmm.
The case was brought under a federal intellectual property law called the Lanham Act.
Well, I've heard of that, the Lanham Act.
And the Lanham Act provides that if you prove infringement, that you're entitled to damages and attorney's fees. So there's a lot at stake in this case.
Sure.
Then it gets interesting. This is a case more about procedure than it is about the intellectual property.
I'm so happy to hear that. I teach civil procedure and I tell them how important it is, so tell us why it's important.
Well, here's how it actually comes out. Nike files the suit. Yum files a denial. We're not infringing on your trademark.
Mm-hmm.
And they also file a counterclaim.
Uh-oh.
And under the Lanham Act, you can actually ask the court to cancel the trademark if it's not properly done.
Oh, but wait a second now. So Yum, far from being intimidated by Big Bad Nike, which you might think they would have been, says not only are we going to deny your infringement claim, we're coming after your basic trademark?
Exactly.
Good. Tell us why that's important.
Well, it's important because the Lanham Act does provide for that. They provide a defense, and they say you can challenge the mark, and it's up to either the administrative agency, the Patent and Trademark Office, or in this case, the district court, to decide whether or not this actually is a valid mark. And so that's what is at risk in this case once Yum files the counterclaim.
That's like saying, if you're coming after me, I'm coming after you and your family.
Exactly.
Okay, so Yum means business. Okay, so what happens?
Well, Nike thought about it a bit, did some good research, and determined that if they were to execute and file with the court something called a covenant not to sue, that they could withdraw the case and essentially game over. Cancel everything.
Even the counterclaim would be canceled.
Even the counterclaim. And
okay,
that's the key to it. And essentially, there's case law that establishes that if you file this covenant not to sue, this promise that you're not going to sue the other side anymore, as long as it's comprehensive, then the case is over. And in fact, this extinguishes the jurisdiction of the court, and so they don't even get to the counterclaim.
Okay, that's so important because, you know, normally speaking, I would tell my civil procedure students that you would never, ever agree to withdraw an original claim unless the counterclaim were also withdrawn. I mean, that would be part of a comprehensive settlement agreement. So that was my original question, but now I see they had an argument that by withdrawing their original infringement claim, Nike did, that would stop everything, including the counterclaim.
Exactly, and that's the issue in this court.
Okay, but did Yum accept that?
Yum did not.
Oh, okay.
In fact, the trial court found in favor of Nike and their position, and in fact they pointed out this is a very comprehensive covenant not to sue, not only for these two lines of shoes, but anything similar, and also for anything in the future. So it was a very comprehensive covenant not to sue, so that Nike could rely on that.
Uh-huh.
And in addition, the trial court said if Yum really wanted to contest this trademark, they could do a procedure in the Patent and Trademark Office.
There's another way to do it,
and
right?
Accomplish the same thing.
Right.
So the court said, we agree with Nike. This covenant not to sue really essentially ends this case.
Right.
And we have no jurisdiction anymore.
Right.
Yum did not accept that. They appealed it to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with Nike. So Yum loses on two levels.
Right.
They petition the U.S. Supreme Court, and probably surprisingly to Nike, the U.S. Supreme Court says, yeah, we'll take this
case. See, that's the big thing, because the Supreme Court doesn't have to take cases.
Correct.
If only four justices say they want to take a case, then the case gets taken. But the general reading is that the Supreme Court only takes a case if there's a pretty good chance they're going to reverse it. So I bet Nike is a little bit concerned about this now.
And I think they should be. My take on this case is that this will give the Supreme Court an opportunity to resolve the issue of covenants not to sue. Because if you do a little bit of research on this, you'll see that this has been a vehicle used by other companies in trademark kinds of disputes. And so they're interested in deciding whether you can use this and under what circumstances.
Oh, boy. Nike's lawyers must be very concerned. Nike must be very concerned. So your prediction is Nike loses?
I think probably.
I
think the covenant not to sue, if not eliminated, I think it's going to be modified quite a bit so that it's not as common as it had been in the past.
Well, you're batting one for one so far, Charlie. We'll come back in a year and we'll see whether you're right on this one. Thanks very much for your time.
And thank you.
All right, next on our roundup of what's happening in the Supreme Court, we're going to transition from footwear to federal employment law with Professor Kendall Isaac.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Absolutely. So, of course, as you know, we're doing this year's roundup. Let's start with the case you talked about last year. It was an EEOC case involving religion as well?
Yes, it was. Hosanna Tabor was the case, and that case dealt with whether or not there was a ministerial exception, which would essentially allow religious entities to not have to deal with the ramifications of discrimination laws like Title VII, age discrimination, disability discrimination, which that case dealt with disability discrimination, because these are ministers of the entity. So it got into establishment clause.
Free exercise. Yeah, normally speaking, you're not allowed if you're an employer to discriminate on the basis of, for example, disability.
Correct.
Maybe we don't apply that rule to a religious institution because maybe they've got a special status. So how did the case turn out?
Yeah, no maybe. Unanimous decision by the Supreme Court.
Which way?
It said that they have the religious freedom to essentially treat their ministers however they want.
I see. So one for God.
Yes, absolutely. God gets a check in the win column there. So, you know, this memo, if you work for a religious entity and you have any function that is ministerial in nature, there's a high possibility you could be deemed a minister of the organization. And you essentially lose your rights to bring discrimination actions for a termination or some other type of adverse employment.
So from the employee's perspective, maybe not such a good decision.
Right, not good for them, but I guess you've got to just put it in the Lord's hands in that case.
Okay, then. So what's the case this year you're looking at?
This year we've got, frankly, a much more complicated case. This case is Carolyn Kleckner versus the Department of Labor, the Secretary of the Department of Labor. Mm-hmm. And this deals with federal employees and the interesting conundrum that happens when federal employees have a mixed case, meaning a case that both deals with whether or not they faced some adverse employment action that was impermissible, and whether or not there was some sort of underlying discrimination that came into play as well.
Okay.
So in this particular one, she alleged that she was discriminated against on the basis of age and sex. She was later terminated. And in the federal sector, you can bring what's called an MSPB, Merit System Protection Board, review of any decision, adverse decision like termination. Mm-hmm. So she had her age and sex discrimination matriculating through the EEOC process. Then she's terminated, so she files an MSPB action as well. Well, the MSPB dismissed her claim as untimely, never reached the merits of her discrimination claim. And so then the issue then becomes a jurisdictional issue, and this gets very complicated. I don't know how deeply you want to get into it. Frankly, if you don't practice in this area, stay away from it. It's a landmine of problems. Honestly, the courts have even said it. It's a landmine of problems. It's,
right, right.
It's hugely complicated and problematic.
Right.
But anyhow, with the jurisdictional issue, what the court is saying, the Eighth Circuit, is that she is limited to bringing her action before the federal circuit, which deals with MSPB decisions, as opposed to...
But that's a specialized appellate court, right?
Correct.
Within
for
the
federal employees,
system,
correct.
Right.
As opposed to bringing it within any district, federal district court, mm-hmm. which deal with general EEOC actions, Title VII, things, discrimination statutes, and they generally have jurisdiction over those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she wants to take it to the district courts, as opposed to the federal circuit. And ultimately, I would like to see the Supreme Court side with the minority of courts and basically draw a clear line in the sand that says, okay, if you file an action and it gets to the MSPB and they're going to look at this discrimination issue, as soon as they decide they're going to look at this discrimination issue, no matter how it's resolved, any appeal goes to the district courts de novo, just like any other. And if it's not dealing with discrimination, so it's not a mixed case, then it goes to the federal circuit. That's how I would like to see it resolved. I'm not sure if that's what's going to happen, but that would be the cleanest way. Well, frankly, the cleanest way would be for Congress to clear up the statute.
To fix the statute.
Okay,
so Congress, you're on notice. Kendall wants you to fix this statute. And Supreme Court, failing that, here's how he wants you to decide it. So we'll come back in a year and we'll see if you were right.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks, Kendall.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this is our annual Supreme Court Roundup episode, where I talk to my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law about interesting cases on the Supreme Court's docket this year. I just finished talking to Charlie Condon and Kendall Isaac about two fascinating cases. After the break, we'll come back. We'll talk briefly about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll speak to Professors Buzz Belleville and Doug McKechnie. Stick around. Time to return to our roundup of what's happening at the United States Supreme Court in 2012. And let's get back to it with Professor Buzz Belleville of the Appalachian School of Law.
So, Buzz Belleville, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. Now, speaking of back, that means you were here last year for a roundup. What was the case we talked about last year?
It was one of those boring commercial cases.
Oh, yes, you bored the pants off of everyone. I got several complaints at the station about your interview.
However, it was one of the ones that actually touches everyone's lives.
It's because it
involved contracts that we deal with in our everyday lives, namely cell phone contracts, cable TV contracts, computer contracts, credit card contracts, that sort of stuff.
And forced arbitration, wasn't it?
Forced arbitration was the issue. And
right.
It's now been firmly resolved that companies can force you into arbitration and can force you to give up rights to bring any class actions.
And you don't sound the least bit happy about this.
Well, from a consumer protection perspective, it is not a good thing.
Right.
There is a reason why these teams of lawyers on the Verizon and the AT&T sides want these provisions. They're not to be good citizens. They think there is some benefit to be gained from the corporate perspective to give up your right to a jury trial.
Oh, you cynic, you. You sound like someone who's actually litigated.
I did in my past life. I'm a recovering litigator. So basically what happened was in the late 2011 term, the AT&T Concepcion decision was decided, which basically said that these class action waiver and forced arbitration provisions were enforceable. They were not unconscionable,
right.
Which my prior contracts casebook had cases in there finding these types of provisions to be unconscionable. That's no longer an argument.
So now the court condones what was previously unconscionable. Was that your prediction last year?
Predictions are a hard word. I don't know that I made a prediction as much as a wish list.
I think Buzz lost.
Let's say I did.
I think Buzz lost
last
year.
Let's say I did.
You're batting zero. Okay.
Well, the case that was last term was actually a case called CompuCredit.
Right.
And it was the same exact issue, except it was underneath a federal statute that guaranteed consumers a right to sue, quote unquote.
Right.
And court said arbitration is good enough for a right to sue. So they upheld the provision in that context. Two interesting offshoots from this decision. Now what we're seeing, because all of these consumer contracts also have what are called change of terms provisions,
right.
Which allows the credit card company or the cell phone company to change the terms at any time.
Ouch.
Usually it was thought to change the rates of your interest or whatnot. But what they're doing now is mailing out these arbitration provisions saying your contract has now been changed to include an arbitration provision and a class action waiver, and if you use your credit card, you accept this offer.
Right, and of course we all read those very carefully.
Right.
And then make our decisions based on that.
So this is something that can actually find its way back up to the court. It's very rare that we commercial geeks get our contract case before the Supreme Court. But this is actually something that's percolating with some divided decisions in the courts below.
All right. Well, you're 0-1 at the moment. So let's see what you've got for us this year.
Well, this year I decided to get a little sexier, I guess, would be a good term. It's it's Kybel versus the Royal Dutch Shell Petroleum Company.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating international law type of case with good, interesting facts. Mm-hmm. Back in the 90s, there was the Ogoni people of Nigeria who were protesting Shell Oil's drilling practices and pipeline laying over in Nigeria, at that time being ruled by a fierce and harsh dictatorship with no real semblance of law.
Mm-hmm.
The protesters were rounded up, tortured,
ooh,
in many cases executed, roundly condemned by the international community as a bad, bad, bad thing,
right?
For obvious reasons. The allegations in this lawsuit this lawsuit was brought by survivors of that experience as well as widows and widowers of those who were actually executed, claiming that Shell was working cahoots with the Nigerian government.
Mm.
This is where you can appreciate as a con law professor, we go back to 1789 and something called the Federal Alien Tort Claims Act.
Yes,
or something
indeed.
Like that.
I thought you were going to be getting there. And the question is whether these people, aggrieved as they are, can come to the United States and file these tort claims, right?
That is correct. That is correct.
Jurisdictional issue.
Well, it's a twofold issue. And the interesting thing, this was actually argued last term under a different issue, and that is, can corporations be liable under the Federal Alien Tort Claims Act?
Right.
How
was that decided?
Well, it was punted until this term.
Oh, okay.
And here's the rub, at least from my perspective or many commentators' perspective, is in light of recent corporate personhood types of decisions typified by most recently the Citizens United decision,
right.
It would be a inconsistent holding for the Supreme Court to say, corporations, you have all the rights of personhood, but you have none of the responsibilities to be held liable.
Oh, yeah. Very interesting,
So that it was a sweeping Second Circuit decision that brought the case before the Supreme Court in which they said corporations cannot be held liable, contrary to the findings of the Ninth Circuit and a couple other circuits, which is how it landed before the Supreme Court. what the Supreme Court did within, and you'll appreciate someone who studies the Supreme Court even more than I do, within a couple days after the argument, they issued an order for re-argument saying, actually, what we want to talk about is jurisdictional. Mm-hmm. Can a foreign citizen sue a foreign company under the Alien Tort Claims Act? Had previously been decided.
Yeah, because let's remember, it's Nigerian plaintiffs versus a Dutch company.
Correct.
So what is it doing in the United States at all?
Well, and that's a good question. There's very little legislative history that survives from the 1789 Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court had previously held in 2004 that as long as the defendant was either present in the United States or was doing business in the United States, they could be hauled into the United States courts.
Okay, so there's your nexus. I mean, Shell is obviously all over the United States.
Correct.
I think I just filled up my car at Shell Station the other day. So they're here, therefore they can be sued here.
Correct.
And this country is known for its aggressive assertion of personal jurisdiction, so that doesn't really surprise me, or at least that argument doesn't surprise me. But is that what ultimately the court is going to decide, whether that's enough?
Well, I think the cynical view of the reorder opinion is that the court recognizes that they can't possibly deny corporate responsibilities at the same time they're granting corporate rights, and they're looking for some other way out of holding Shell liable for this, or forcing Shell to defend itself in court.
These are
just motion to dismiss. Mm-hmm. I don't want to suggest that Shell did engage in these practices, but we're just at the, can Shell be hauled into court to answer for these practices?
Okay, so what looks at first glance like a complex and perhaps even a little bit dull jurisdictional issue really will possibly decide this whole case, because if there's no jurisdiction, there ain't no case.
And the ramifications for international law are relatively significant. I mean, you know, although there is something called the International Court of Justice, as you may or may not know, the United States has not agreed to its jurisdictional.
Right. It's called toothless to a great extent.
Advisory opinions, that sort of stuff. So
people all over the world want to come here, especially in tort claims, because we have a well-developed tort law, and because, in appropriate cases at least, they can get significant damages awards. But that's really not the case in a lot of other places. So if the United States is not a place to litigate these cases, that'll have major repercussions for international law.
How do you enforce human rights law but for the national courts of various nations? And when you're talking about something that happens in Nigeria without a developed court system run by a brutal dictatorship, there is no recourse. So we sign these international treaties. If we're going to sign off on these human rights treaties, you know, our courts have decided in the past that we will give teeth to them, and we will enforce
them. I think
them.
I know where you want the court to come out on this, but what do you predict?
I predict that they will not force Shell, that they're going to, I think they're looking for an angle. Short of saying corporations can't be responsible, they're looking for an angle to not force Shell to defend this. And I think that it's something to the effect of foreign national versus foreign company, there needs to be some greater nexus to the United States than just doing business here.
So they're going to decide in favor of Shell and say there's no jurisdiction.
I don't know why else they would have that reordered, that re-argument decision in light of a 2004 opinion that most folks thought resolved the jurisdictional argument.
Well, Buzz Belville, the resident cynic at the Appalachian School of Law,
I can.
Thank you, and we'll come back in a year and we'll see if your prediction comes true.
Hope I'm wrong.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's finish up our 2012 roundup of the U.S. Supreme Court's docket with Professor Doug McKechnie.
Well, Doug McKechnie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me back, Stuart.
Absolutely. I've been curious about what we talked about last year, the Fox Communications case. What was that one about?
The Fox versus FCC versus Fox case was the case about fleeting expletives.
The dirty talk.
The dirty talk, right? The dirty words. Uh-huh. I've once again returned to your weekly Constitutional to talk about dirty words.
Talking Dirty with Doug, part two. All right.
So, as your listeners may recall, the court was reviewing a decision by the FCC that punished some of the broadcasters, Fox and a couple other broadcasters, for the use of fleeting expletives during some broadcasts.
Right.
Now, what the broadcasters had alleged was that over time, the FCC's interpretations of their own regulations had changed, and indeed some of the substance had changed, but in a way that didn't give them notice as to what would be a violation of FCC rules regarding fleeting expletives and fleeting scenes of nudity.
Wardrobe malfunctions at the Super Bowl, and I think Bono dropped the F-bomb on a live broadcast, things of that sort.
Yeah, Cher had a couple of things that she said, and some right. NYPD Blues programming as well.
Yeah, I remember NYPD Blue, of course, I remember. Okay, so did who won the case?
Well, technically, Fox and its cohorts, the other broadcasters, won the case on a very narrow technicality.
But that means you win, right?
I guess. I'll take it.
Okay, you take it. Okay, so we chalk one up in the win column for Doug, but you say it was a narrow ruling?
It was an extreme. Well, commentators, and I would agree with them, most commentators think that it was a very narrow ruling. Most commentators were hoping that the Supreme Court would make a decision with regard to the FCC's authority, general authority under the First Amendment to regulate the airwaves and regulate what's kind of called, typically called obscenity over the airwaves, offensive language, yeah. things of that nature. And so this case, everyone was hoping, or a lot of people were hoping, that the Supreme Court would say either yes, the FCC can regulate the airwaves, like we've said in the past that they can, going way back to 1978 with George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words. We're going to affirm that, or nope, we're going to get rid of that ruling and say that the FCC may not regulate the airwaves. There were a lot of people hoping that the court would come down one way or the other.
And they didn't come down clearly one way or the other?
They didn't. What they ended up saying was that they actually agreed with the Second Circuit, and that was the court out of New York that heard this case. They agreed that the application of the FCC's regulations in this particular case, so applied to Fox and some of its broadcasting brethren, was vague. And so what the court said was that that Fox really had no way to know whether or not any particular fleeting expletive or fleeting indecent exposure of body parts was going to violate the FCC's rules. And so the way they were written and the way they were enforced was vague and unconstitutional. What the court did not say was whether or not the FCC may continue to regulate the airwaves.
Or even whether this was a particularly good rule or not.
That's right.
In other words, they did what an intermediate appellate court is supposed to do, which is decide the case.
That's right.
But they didn't necessarily do what the United States Supreme Court is supposed to do, which is to make the grand pronouncement and give guidance to the future. I mean, they didn't really give any guidance then, did they?
They said to the FCC, you're free to go back and change the policies. You can keep them if you want. But if you decide to keep them, it's very likely that you'll be back with another constitutional challenge. And maybe we'll see you back in court in a couple of years.
Oh, man, what a disappointment.
Yeah, so.
What a disappointment. Oh, boy, that sounds almost like a punt. But okay, at least you won. The Fox Communications or Fox won the case. So what's the one you're looking at for this term?
Okay, this term, a case that I thought your listeners might find interesting is Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin.
Oh, I'm so glad you're talking about this. I was hoping that one of my colleagues would talk about this. This is the case of this term, isn't it?
I guess I would consider it one of the cases, if not the case. And you and I may consider it the case. Our interest in the constitutional issues that arise out of the case, particularly the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause.
Right.
And so to remind your listeners, the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause states that states may not deny to any person within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Mm-hmm. And so strictly construed, what that means is that states may not create laws that deny opportunities to their citizens based on some kind of intrinsic characteristic.
Yeah, like race.
Right, race, gender,
that sort of thing, right?
Perhaps disability, things of mm-hmm. that nature. And so in this particular case, the court is struggling with not a law that denies access to certain benefits provided by the government, but in fact, kind of the reverse. It attempts to ameliorate previous discrimination.
Affirmative action. This is the affirmative action case of the 21st century, right?
It is.
Or the second major affirmative
action. I guess, technically.
The 21st century. because, of course, this one is, it seems to be a replay of the companion cases of Grutter and Gratz. Right?
I would agree with that, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you want to talk to your listeners about Gratz, and then I can pick up with Grutter.
Well, I'll go all the way back to Bakke.
Oh,
we've
okay.
had this. We've had cases on affirmative action in higher education since at least the late 1970s. Bakke was a white guy, University of California, wanted to go to medical school. He was denied. He claimed that they denied him because he was white. Court sided with him, said that they couldn't have quotas, but that they could take race into account as they did admissions, and that was the law when companion cases from the University of Michigan, Gratz and Grutter, came forward. And the court basically said the same thing, didn't it, in those cases?
They did. In that case, Grutter is the one, from my reading, that is most often cited and discussed in the Fisher case. The court in Grutter talked about the Michigan law school and its use of race in trying to create a diverse student body.
Right.
And the court said, when higher education institutions are using race to create a more diverse student body, that diversity encourages the educational process, it encourages students to be able to work in a diverse atmosphere, and therefore it furthers the educational process in a kind of an enriching way.
And so race is okay to consider in a holistic review of the entire applicant's file, and it's one factor among many. That's okay. But quotas or, you know, mechanistic point systems are not okay.
That's correct.
That's been the law of the land in the Grutter case. And it was something interesting about Grutter, too, wasn't there? At the very end of the case, what did Justice O'Connor say about time?
Oh, well, the justice that wrote the Grutter case was Justice O'Connor, and she said that her hope, and I think she was reflecting the hope of the majority at the time, was that these policies that higher education institutions are using to try to increase diversity and increase opportunity would only be necessary for a finite amount of time.
25 years.
25 years.
Which is extraordinary. I mean, that's the only time I can recall having seen a case with a fuse on it. You know,
right.
That, you know, said this is it's constitutional now to do this, but we hope and maybe even expect that affirmative action is not going to last much longer than another quarter century. So what's up? What's going on now with Fisher?
Well, I think before we get into a discussion of Fisher, I think it's interesting to note the makeup of the court and how it's changed since the Grutter case. And so the Grutter case, there are only two. So the Grutter case was decided on a 5-4 basis, 5 justices voting in the majority and 4 voting in the dissent, the dissenters obviously disagreeing with the university, the Michigan law school's right to use race as a factor in admissions. There were 5 that voted in favor of that policy, 4 that voted against its constitutionality. Of the 5 that voted in favor of the Michigan law school being able to use race as a factor, only 2 of the justices from that majority are still on the court. That's Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer.
Uh-huh.
And so that, I think, is going to be interesting because those who voted in the dissent, there are more dissenters on the court from the original case than there are those who voted in the majority.
And among those who have come onto the court in the last 7 years, I sense there's not a great deal of support for affirmative action, is there?
There's not. Of the 4 dissenters from the Grutter case, those were Justices Kennedy, Scalia, and Thomas. They're still there. And then in addition, there are a couple new justices who are very likely to vote with those 3 justices from the dissent in Grutter. Justice Roberts and Justice Alito are new to the bench, and it's very likely that they will vote with those old dissenters. And indeed, Justice Kagan, who is also new to the bench since the Grutter case, she has recused herself because of her work for the administration.
Well, she was Solicitor General.
That's right.
Yeah, so there are only 8 people sitting on this, and of those 8 people, it looks like maybe at best 3 of them might vote to uphold Grutter.
And it's very likely that 5 will vote to either overrule Grutter or vote and say that Justice O'Connor's prediction of 25 years wasn't necessary, and maybe only 10 years.
Wasn't necessary.
Just slightly less than 10 years was necessary.
The facts of this case are fairly straightforward. If you correct me if I'm wrong, but basically Fisher's a young white woman. She wanted to go to the University of Texas. She was denied admission. She claimed that it was because of the racial preferences that were given to other students. And so this is really just a replay of the Grutter and Gratz cases.
It is. There are a couple of facts that are slightly different. Texas has an admissions plan that requires admissions to its state universities of anyone in the state of Texas, any high school student that that graduates in his or her top 10% of the class. And in addition, one of the other things that
She didn't get in under that.
She did not get in under that policy.
And that's like 80%.
That's almost 80% of the incoming freshman classes at the University of Texas and its satellite campuses.
And that policy itself is not at issue, but that's also designed to be an affirmative action policy.
That's true, and it's actually accomplished its goals. I mean, it has increased diversity.
Because there are a lot of schools that are predominantly minority.
That's right.
And so the top 10% of those schools is going to be a minority. Okay, so that's not an issue. She didn't make it into that top 10% from her own high school, so now she's in this other 20%.
She's fighting for this 20%.
Right, and in that pool, they're taking into account race, you know, among other factors, and she's saying that because of that, I was denied admission. There are people there whose scores or GPAs are lower than mine, but they're minorities, and so I'm being discriminated against.
That's right. And in addition, one of the points that she makes is that the University of Texas at Austin, which is the one that she was trying to gain access to, they were using this admissions plan not just for to increase diversity or using it for considering race in admission for this 20% of seats that are left open, not just kind of on a broad scale for the entire entering freshman class, but also on a more kind of small scale purpose. So they were trying to increase diversity based on the majority, the major fields of study, and at a classroom level. And so it's not just across the spectrum of all entering freshmen. It's trying to increase diversity or considering race for the purposes of
down to the
majors, and so we
want to make sure that in every class we're going to have a cross section, a representative cross section of Texas society,
or at least increasing diversity at that small scale level.
Wow, that's a very aggressive policy. Mm-hmm. I can see them doing that,
and it's been successful. They, I think, are one of the top 10 most diverse university systems in the country.
And they'll be arguing diversity, 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 and they've got lots of Amici. They've got lots of people arguing on their side. What's your prediction? I think you've already given it, right?
I think Grutter will be overruled, or I think that the Supreme Court will say the time has come and racial preferences are no longer necessary.
Doug, much obliged. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir. Okay.
That's our Supreme Court Roundup for 2012. Thanks very much to my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law, Judy Barger, Pat Baker, Charlie Condon, Kendall Isaac, Buzz Belleville, and Doug McKechnie. You know, if you're listening on the internet, we're also a radio show. And if you'd like to hear us on your local public radio station, by golly, give them a call and tell them to start carrying your weekly constitutional. Believe me, we'll be happy to hear from them. If you're listening on the radio, you know, we're also a podcast. So just get online, go to a search engine, Google, Bing, whatever you like, and type in your weekly constitutional. We've got more than 60 podcasts up already. You can listen to every single one of them. Just drive your spouse crazy. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your constitution, and you need to learn about it.